I am Jo Van Cool, one of four people who are taking over our new programme, Animates. We have given much thought as to how we can best offer our listeners a fortnightly session that covers topics of interest on animals, reptiles, birds and fish. In addition to this, we are concerned to present topics that will be informative for those with all kinds of disabilities as well as the disadvantaged in our society. The other members of our team are Fran Telic, Annie Kiefer and Peter Miller. While we will combine to find items of interest, we will take it in turns to present the programme. We hope it won't be long before you become used to our various voices and enjoy what we have to offer. Our first programme for Animates is of a fairly general nature and will serve as a template for future presentations. It is planned to offer interviews with those either involved in the animal business or those for whom their animals are not only friends but a necessary part of everyday life. In due course, we'd love your feedback on this new format. Our first thought was to locate someone who is involved with animals and highly qualified to understand how they operate. Today's guest, then, is an animal behaviourist, Dr. Kirsty Sexel.
Thank you for joining us, Kirsty. It's lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to be here.
Can you tell us, for our listeners' benefit, what actually is an animal behaviourist?
Well, there's a lot of people that can call themselves an animal behaviourist. I'm not an animal behaviourist. I'm a veterinary specialist in behavioural medicine, which is different. So I'm kind of like the psychiatrist for the dog and cat world or the animal world. Mm-hmm. So I'm a veterinarian with additional degrees in psychology as well as specialisation in that. An animal behaviourist might be someone who has a qualification in zoology or biology, for instance. They may or may not be a veterinarian, and in some cases they may not have any qualifications at all. It's a very complex field, and that's what makes it quite difficult when people are searching for help with their animal is to know who to actually go to.
Yes, I can imagine. Being an animal owner myself, I think it's a fascinating field. And how do you actually deal with them when they can't answer you back?
Well, see, it's not dissimilar, I think. My profession certainly is like being a paediatric psychiatrist or a paediatric psychologist.
Yes, true,
and
yes.
They're dealing with nonverbal communicators, and perhaps it's not dissimilar to being a geriatric psychiatrist because, again, sometimes when people get dementia, they're not able to express how their emotions are, but we can certainly hazard a good guess at how they might be feeling by observing their behaviour.
Body language and so forth, is that right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And do you see this, as many of us do, animal owners and lovers as we are, do you see this as an integral part of animal care, and in what ways would that be?
Mm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like, I guess it's only in the relatively recent years we've been recognising that people may have mental health issues, and now we're recognising or at least acknowledging that animals also have mental health issues. We know that 20% of people have an anxiety disorder sometime in their life, and it's about the same in dogs. So it is integral in looking after the animal's physical health. We also have to look after their mental health. So, you know, it's something that more and more veterinarians are getting training in, and more veterinarians are undertaking additional courses and becoming specialists in the field too. So, like psychiatry, I guess, was one of the last fields that was developed in the human medical field as a specialty, because it's complex. The mind is a very complex organism, and yet it controls everything that we do. It controls our emotions. It can affect how your gastrointestinal system reacts to things. If you're stressed, you're more likely to have gut problems. It can certainly affect your skin. People who are stressed, animals who are stressed, often get skin problems like psoriasis. So it's absolutely part of how we deal with animals on a day-to-day basis.
Makes a lot of sense to me, absolutely. So you'd say then, presumably, would you, an animal that has been abandoned or has been mistreated in some way would benefit from your treatment? And would it be more difficult to treat an animal that's been through some difficult times?
Well, I think to go back to basics, all behaviours, whether you're a dog or a cat or a guinea pig or a person, there are three things that affect the way you're going to behave in a situation. So the first thing is your genetic predisposition, what you've inherited from your ma, your pa, your grandpa, your grandma. And then there's also what you've learnt from previous experiences, good, bad and indifferent, also affect the behaviour. And the current situation that you're in, the environment you're in, also affects the way you behave. So if you've developed resiliency early in life or you have had some really bad experiences early in life, yeah, they're going to affect the way that you might behave or react in certain situations. Does it make them more difficult to treat? I think the longer it's been going on before people seek help for their pet, the harder it is, because some of these behaviours have become almost automatic defaults. You know, they see a person and they're scared, so that's what happens. Mm. But certainly we can help these animals to live, you know, hopefully more happy and harmonious lives if we get to treat them early and understand that they are mental health issues. These are not animals that generally we can train out of the disease, just like we can't train an animal or a person out of diabetes. We can't train them out of an anxiety disorder. We can certainly use behaviour modification techniques. We can certainly use medication. There's lots of other things that we do to manage the environment, but it's not simple as a training issue. So the more an animal's been abused or traumatised, the harder it is to work with them, just like it is with people.
The old nature and nurture argument, of course, yes. Now, to turn the conversation around a little bit, as you know, our programme is about the benefit that animals can bring to the lives of disadvantaged and disabled people. Can you speak about that a little bit?
There's been lots and lots of published studies now looking at how animals can benefit people in all sorts of ways, from a physical illness to a mental health issue. And I guess the first thing to say is if you don't like animals, animals aren't going to be a benefit to you. You know, if you're allergic to cats or you dislike dogs, then having a pet like that is not going to be helpful. But I've certainly done visits to nursing homes where I've seen the elderly, sometimes with dementia. We've taken animals there and just to see the people's faces when they, you know, suddenly have the ability to touch an animal, to pet an animal that they didn't have for ages. I've certainly worked with people where the dog is there. It is not only what we're, I guess, more familiar with is, you know, guide dogs for the blind and hearing assistance dogs, but I also know dogs who are diabetic alert dogs. I know dogs that are companion dogs for people who are afraid of going out. So having the dog with them in social situations can make a big, big difference. So I think rather than just being anecdotal, I do think we have some strong physical evidence, but it depends on the animal, it depends on the person, and it depends on the harmony between them and who else is around to help them.
Yes, of course. Are there any specifics that you could go into around how one would approach a person with a disability initially to introduce the idea of perhaps thinking about having some interaction with an animal, you know, someone who perhaps hasn't ever considered this as an option?
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, we now have assistance dogs for all sorts of people. We have hearing alert dogs. We have, you know, dogs who alert people who, if they have seizures, can help. And again, I think it depends very much on if the person actually likes dogs. And there are certainly some people who are afraid of dogs, some cultures who don't like having dogs around, and that can make it difficult. But I've certainly seen people that maybe come from that culture, they've heard about having an assistance dog or a guide dog for the blind, and they have made leaps and bounds in their independence and their ability to get around. Certainly Mind Dog and other org associations like that, and I have friends who have dogs as companions because it is their support network, if you want to call it that. They're able to engage in doing things with other people because of the fact that they have that animal around. And I think the animal often breaks the bond as well. You know, if you, you know, I know if I walk my dog down the street and somebody comments on the dog, I'm much happier to chat to the person than if some stranger just came up to me and started chatting. The dog
isn't that
a
funny thing?
Is that icebreaker and community network?
Yeah.
And there's so many stories and I guess reports of people. They go to the park, they know the names of all the dogs, but they don't know the owners. And we've all had, I guess, as veterinary behaviourist stories of, you know, Mrs. So-and-so wasn't at the park that day. They, you know, and it's not they know Mrs. So-and-so, but they know the dog.
Yeah,
and
if
Fido wasn't there, let's go find out. And certainly in one case, I know she'd fallen down the stairs, and it was only because all the people knew that the dog wasn't there that they went to find her and were able to seek help for her. So, you know, there's lots of good stories about that. But as I said before, you've got to like the animals. You're not, you know, you've got to know that there are lots and lots and lots of organisations that can help to put you in touch with that.
And you've sort of answered a question I wanted to put to you about animal interaction with humans on a more on a less formal basis. I mean, you know, like bringing animals into hospitals to help people with their recovery and so forth without, you know, necessarily being an assistance dog or anything like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The Delta Society has people that work with their animals on a regular basis, going to nursing homes, hospitals, hospices, children's wards, because often it's that waggy tail and that happiness that that dog has to see people, and that animals don't have to live with them, but having access to that can make a difference. And there's been a number of studies showing that just patting your dog can decrease your blood pressure and decrease your triglyceride level. There's been studies to show that recovery from having heart attacks is better if you have animals around, and not because you necessarily exercise them, because everybody thinks, oh, well, if you have a dog, you walk them more.
Yeah.
It's just their presence that can make such a difference in your cortisol levels and your stress levels. And I guess, you know, it's the happiness quotient that comes in a waggy tail, really.
Yes, of course, I agree. Do you think the expectations of our society measure up to animal care? I mean, are we looking after our animals as well as we should be, in other words? What's your feeling about that?
Yeah, look, I think in general, yes, we are. I think the average person with the average pet looks after them the best of their ability and knowledge. Where things go pear-shaped, I think, is where people don't have the knowledge, and it's lack of information about the best way to look after their pets. And if they always just thought, well, the dog should be outside and, you know, I'll just throw it, you know, some food and water, that's all it needs. Well, we now know a lot more about dogs, for instance, that they're a social animal. They actually thrive on interaction with people, and if we don't interact with them, we can lead to some issues with them. So it's, if people aren't looking after them, it's often due to lack of knowledge about the appropriate care. And I guess that's why we as veterinarians and lots of other organisations are doing their best to educate people about the best way we should be looking after them based on our current scientific knowledge.
Mm. In your time as an animal behaviourist, let's just call you that for shorthand for the purposes of this interview, do you think your attitudes generally to animals have changed?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. No, I think I've always really respected animals. I've been intrigued by the way they behave and why they do what they do. I've always been really interested in watching them, I guess, just as much as people watching. I like watching animals. The reason I became a veterinary behaviourist, I think, was during my time when I was working in the UK as a veterinarian in general practice. And I found that when we started looking at the numbers of animals that were being euthanized or surrendered, it was usually due to the greatest number was due to their behavior rather than the fact that they actually had some other disease processes we couldn't fix. And for me, for spending 5 years at university and not being able to help most of my patients was pretty distressing. So I don't know that my attitudes change. I think I've learnt a lot more about them. I understand them better. I think we've still got a long, long, long way to go. But I think my attitude to them is the fact that they deserve our respect and they make a wonderful part of our lives.
They sure do. And now a question I think is going to be interesting for some of our listeners. What do you think are the positives and negatives of keeping an animal of any kind, but I suppose particularly perhaps a dog or a cat, in a unit?
I think there's nothing wrong with it at all. Having worked in New York and London, let me tell you, there's a lot of pets that live in units and they cope really, really well. I think culturally in Australia, we sometimes think they need sunshine and a big backyard, but in fact we can provide for their mental and physical health really well in a unit as long as we understand the needs of the particular species we've got in there. Ours, not always do our strata laws allow that to happen, but I see it's changing. We're able to take animals into lots of different places that we couldn't otherwise, but if you go on to, you know, any... most of the European countries, the US, UK, you know, you'll go to the local pub or restaurant, there'll be somewhere for the animals. They live in units, there's not a problem. I think culturally we often think, well, you know, we have to have small animals in small places, but Great Danes and Greyhounds are probably ideal pets to live in a unit. And a little busy dog maybe isn't. Cats are fine in units. In fact, they're probably safer there, then they're not going to get run over, they're not going to get into cat fights. As long as we provide lots of vertical space and three-dimensional space for the cats, they do really well. So, you know, a very bad cliche, horses for courses, but a lot of the animals do really well as long as we pick the right one and we look after their mental health and physical health.
Yes, well, that's it from us. And thanks so much for a really interesting interview. And sorry it's a little bit rushed, but thanks so much for your time, Kirsty.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed this first programme of Animates, and we look forward to more programmes featuring other stories in a week or two. This is Jo Van Kool saying goodbye for now.